Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Ah, a new year. Goodbye and good riddance to the old one. At least if you had a retirement nest egg or a college fund or even a savings account. 2009 just has to be better, right? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. A very happy new year to everyone, and many thanks for joining us on this 1st of January, the opening day of 2009. We begin today with not just New Year's greetings, but birthday greetings as well. The first, to my mom, and next, to the euro. The European single currency is 10 years old today. And it's in pretty good shape, despite the global financial crisis. 16 member countries of the European Union now use it, an area that stretches from Cyprus to Ireland and from Portugal to Finland. There are now more euros in circulation than U.S. dollars. But as our Stephen Beard reports, the euro's beginnings back in January 1999 were far from auspicious.
With this ecstatic rendition of Land of Hope and Glory, the euro was born. It then hit the currency markets and dropped like a stone.
It went into a very, very sharp plunge on the very first day, and it didn't stop. It didn't go down well.
Money broker Howard Wealdon says that traders called the euro a toilet currency and dumped it fast. Within 2 years, it had fallen almost a third against the dollar. Economist Andrew Hilton predicted the euro wouldn't survive. One currency with one interest rate just wouldn't work for a dozen or so different economies.
I didn't think that it would last a decade, and I certainly didn't think that it should last a decade, so I have to eat my words and say I was wrong.
Today, the euro is riding high, a haven of stability in turbulent times. It has flourished largely due to dollar weakness, but Gideon Rachman of the Financial Times says the euro is now entering its most testing period, with the eurozone in recession.
Different countries in this recession we're heading into, that we've actually already started, we'll need different levels of interest rates and different policies, and that could cause strains within the euro group.
But on its 10th birthday, and in these testing times, the euro can derive a quantum of solace from an unusual quarter.
The name's Bond. James Bond.
In the latest Bond movie, the villain pays his conspirators in euros because, quote, the dollar isn't what it once was. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
One more reason to cheer the new year. Many of America's least paid workers just got a raise. The minimum wage went up today in about a dozen states. In some cases, it's a couple of dollars or more higher than the federal benchmark of $6.55 an hour. But some observers say the change will hurt more than it will help. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
Many states approved increasing the minimum wage years ago by tying it to the Consumer Price Index.
They have put the minimum wage law on autopilot.
That's Rick Berman with the Employment Policies Institute. He says small business owners are already struggling to support higher costs for things like rent and energy.
You can do with fewer employees, and that's what happens especially to the low-skilled people in the workforce. They're the first ones to go.
Santa Fe, New Mexico now has the nation's highest minimum wage at $9.92 an hour. As wages went up, some restaurants cut back. Roland Richter owns Joe's Diner and Pizza.
We made adjustments in the menu. We made it smaller. We aren't open as many hours as we used to be.
Richter made these changes in order to reduce staff.
We used to have as many as 40 people here, and now we're down to about 26.
But not everyone agrees that higher minimum wages automatically lead to layoffs. Harley Shaken is a labor economist at UC Berkeley.
There's a lot of academic research that indicates that previous raises in the minimum wage have in fact not resulted in lost jobs, or in some cases can even create jobs.
And he says it stimulates the economy.
Minimum wage workers spend that money.
That's not much consolation to Ken Belisle with Landmark Restaurants. He oversees four eateries in Spokane, Washington, where the state minimum wage just got bumped up by 48 cents to $8.55 an hour. He faces competition from nearby Idaho, where the minimum wage is $2 lower.
You get kind of an influx of their folks coming here to want to work, and you get an influx of our guests and customers going there to eat, because you'll see a difference in the prices.
In July, the federal minimum wage is set to increase to $7.25 an hour. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Major financial markets around the world were closed for the holiday today. As the calendar turns, we'll take a look at some of the dismal facts and figures we leave behind when we do the numbers. I saw an item at a major houseware chain this week that was marked down 50% from its original price. Then there was a red line through it, and the next price was another 60% off, plus a coupon if you had one. Can prices possibly get any lower? You know, in this economy, it seems like the whole world is on sale. Homes, clothes, stocks, cars. What could be wrong with that, right? Well, turns out lots of things. In this installment of the Marketplace Decoder, Stacey Vanek-Smith explains deflation.
So there's this great-looking gold purse I've had my eye on at the Anthropologie store. It was $248. Then it was $199. And now it's $130. So I should probably make my move, but I think I'm going to wait. I think it's going to get marked down even more now that the holidays are over. Pretty impressive bargain shopping, right? Actually, Matthew Lloyd of Advisors Asset Management says I'm damaging the economy. He says all of my holding out is contributing to a dangerous phenomenon known as deflation.
To put it in the most simple terms, it's negative inflation.
Inflation happens when there's too much money chasing too few goods and prices go up. Deflation happens when there's not enough spending and prices start falling. That flips a switch in consumers' brains and they start to hang back, kind of like my purse situation. Suddenly, companies can't get people to buy their stuff, they can't grow, and the economy grinds to a halt.
Companies end up starting to contract, and then they start laying off employees. And then the consumer starts to feel more tepid about the future, so they spend less, and it starts that deflationary spiral.
Lloyd says counteracting deflation is tricky because there's not a lot the government can do to prevent people from waiting for the next markdown.
No one can come up with a quantitative formula to define a human being and their spending habits. You can't really address the situation through certain policies.
Deflation whacked the U.S. economy back in the 40s, but this round could be far more serious, says Robert Manning, professor of consumer finance at the Rochester Institute of Technology. He says U.S. consumer spending has become the engine of the global economy.
We're in a very perilous situation with the economy. And every help that we can to get people out of debt and being able to afford buying new goods and services is going to be crucial to restarting this economy.
So if I don't buy that purse, I could help push the entire world into a horrible deflationary spiral? Okay, I'm sold. Things are hard enough without having global economic ruin on my conscience. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Just when you thought it was safe to put 08 behind you, a reminder of months past. Today, Bank of America finalized its purchase of Merrill Lynch. That makes it the largest U.S. bank with some $2.7 trillion worth of assets. You may remember the merger was announced a scant hour before Lehman Brothers collapsed on September 15th. It added to the unreal list that already included Bear Stearns, Fannie, Freddie, IndyMac, and eventually engulfed WaMu, Detroit, and of course the bailout. But here's the remarkable thing. All of it, everything, began with the collapse of the housing market. Nick Ritsinas is the director of Harvard University's Joint Center for Housing Studies. Hi, Nick, and welcome back.
Nice to be with you.
So the subprime mortgage story really started at the beginning of the year last year and rolled into this one. But what was the housing story this year, do you think?
Not a very pretty picture. It was a very, very difficult year for housing. We did start to set lots of records, but all the records were negative records. Housing starts fell to a 50-year low. Housing sales dropped precipitously, and housing prices declined. So it was a very, very difficult year for housing in 2008.
Let's talk about what the government tried to do to help homeowners this past year. We had programs called Hope Now, Project Lifeline. But, you know, if memory serves, the government itself even said, those didn't work.
Good intentions, but if one looks back with all the, I might add, clarity of hindsight, you know, back a year from now in November 2007, the initial government response was voluntary modification. Modifications of loans by the banks where investors and borrowers would come together and agree on a way out. That didn't gain much traction. Indeed, the problem got worse and worse, and now we're well beyond the phase where voluntary modifications is going to get us out of this.
Even the modifications that were done, a lot of those people ended up in foreclosure anyway.
According to a recent study by the Comptroller of the Currency, over half of the loans that were modified at the beginning of the year have redefaulted, calling into question whether the loan modifications, in fact, were truly modifications or they were just very temporary stopgap measures.
So, Nick, what should have been done and what might still be possible to save us from this ongoing foreclosure problem?
Let me start at the end. I don't know whether at this point it's possible to be saved. Matter of fact, I think we're really at the end of the beginning of the problem. Because with people losing their jobs, that puts a limit on any kind of modification. Because even if you reduce an interest rate or extend a term, if you're not working, you can't pay it back. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't still attack this problem. I do think we need to have a much more activist government. I think we should revisit bankruptcy reform as a way to encourage investors and servicers and lenders to be more aggressive in trying to stem the tide of foreclosures. Because, Tess, everything is related to everything. The foreclosures is one of the reasons we have widespread price declines. And if prices continue to decline, buyers will continue to stand on the sidelines.
But you still hear this argument from folks who say, you know what, I pay my mortgage. Why should I be responsible for helping the people who made such big mistakes?
And that is a very, very legitimate question. Part of the answer to that is the externalities. By that, I mean, if your neighbor loses their home and their home is foreclosed upon, just that mere reality, that mere fact lowers your home. American households have lost over $3 trillion in wealth because of a declining housing market. I would submit that would argue for some kind of intervention, understanding that in the end, we may end up helping some people who don't deserve to be helped. But by standing on the sidelines, matters can only get worse.
Nick Ritsinas heads up Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies. Thanks so much, as always.
Always a pleasure.
As Nick just noted, the large number of home foreclosures, sadly, was one of the big stories of 2008. This week, we're revisiting a few folks we met last year, and today we turn to a family that experienced the foreclosure story firsthand. Last February, reporter Mari Saito spoke with John and Vicki Glicken of Lyndhurst, Ohio, a suburb of Cleveland. When we last heard from the Glickens, they were struggling to make their monthly mortgage payments. They had an adjustable rate mortgage that led them into bankruptcy proceedings.
We were naive in a lot of areas.
Sure.
And we take responsibility for that. We went through a counseling session as part of your Chapter 13, and it requires you to come up with a budget. We're trying to follow the steps, and this just keeps going up and up and up.
And John and Vicki Glicken are back with us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
John, let me start with you. What has happened since then?
Well, since then, we actually have moved. We've been struggling, actually, prior to February of trying to get a loan modification. There was an offer on the table, but it was exactly the same type of loan we would have signed, and we did sign in the first place. And basically, short of the story, the minute they received a $700 billion bailout, the offer was pulled off the table. Now, I don't know if that was coincidental or not.
So what did you end up doing? Did you walk away from your home?
Yes. Yeah, we walked away 2 weeks ago, as a matter of fact. We're still in Lyndhurst, Ohio, and we are renting.
Vicki, what's it been like leaving your old home?
It was very sad, and we were very angry for a period of time, but we actually feel a little bit relieved right now because at least we know we're in a home, and we know that our son is, he's a teenager, so it's very important to them that they're in the same school, you know, that they've been in, and they're with their friends, and that was important to be able to do that for him.
Vicki, now that you are in foreclosure, where do you place the blame for your current situation?
My husband and I, you know, took responsibility for our part in it because we were naive. We wish now that we would have known Richard, our attorney, back when we signed the papers, because we would have had him, you know, review them. But there are so many people, families, that are in the same situation that we are. So I think that the banking industry need to take responsibility also, because I think a lot of people knew exactly what they were doing, and I think they were very greedy. And I think those people are still being greedy, and I think that's a shame.
John, although it's become more and more prevalent, foreclosure is, of course, a black mark on your credit history. Was it hard at all finding a new place to live because of that?
It was extremely difficult, and in all reality, the house that we're staying in now, it took about 2 months for them to finally say yes. Our hope is one day that we could actually purchase this home later on down the road.
Vicki, what are your plans now for 2009? Do you see it as a fresh start?
We're trying to look at it that way because I think that's more of a positive outlook. We hope to be able to go forward and possibly be able to do a rent-to-own option and stay in this home.
Well, John and Vicki Glicken of Lyndhurst, Ohio, thanks so much for updating us, and I do hope it is a happy new year for you.
Well, I appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Coming up, help meeting your New Year's resolutions.
We all try diets on our own. It's just too hard to do. But put it in a group setting, put it in a competitive type setting, and the results are amazing.
But first, let's do the numbers. Markets were closed today to mark the start of 2009, a quiet moment to reflect on the past year and how much we'd like to forget it. The Dow Jones Industrial Average tumbled 33.8% last year, off its high of 13,261.82. It closed at 8,776. The S&P fell 38.5%, closing at 903.25, the worst performances for the Dow and the S&P since the 1930s. The Nasdaq dropped around 40% to about 1577. Markets around the world, of course, did not do well either, with one exception, the Tunisia Index. Yes, that tiny country above Libya in northern Africa was the only market to end in positive territory this year, up 10%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Want more from Marketplace's special Fallout coverage? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, videos, and the Marketplace Decoder, a simple guide to financial terms and products. Go to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events for Friday. Incoming Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel will resign his seat in the House of Representatives. The College Bowl games continue. The Cotton, Sugar, and Liberty Bowls will all be played. And in 1974, President Richard Nixon signed a bill lowering the nation's speed limit to 55 miles per hour to conserve gas during an OPEC embargo. I'm Millie Jefferson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. St. Barnabas Medical Center of Livingston, New Jersey is claiming the first U.S. birth of 2009. It says Edgar Rafael Moreno was born there 1 second after midnight, Eastern Standard Time, of course. But residents of Guam might have something to say about that. They're claiming the first baby born on U.S. soil at 13 seconds past midnight, Chamorro Standard Time, 15 hours ahead of New Jersey. I don't know. I report. You decide. Anyway, Baby New Year aside, there are some predictions that 09 might see something of a baby bust. What with the recession at all? Marketplace's Rico Galliano looked into it.
Seem like the country's a little more crowded than usual these days? That's because, well, it is. Stephanie Ventura is a demographer at the National Center for Health Statistics.
Actually, in 2006, the overall birth rate increased 3%, so we had the largest number of births since 1961.
And 2007 saw the most births in American history. But thanks to the recession, we may soon be getting a little more elbow room.
I would imagine that the economic downturn would involve some kind of a baby bust.
That's Carl Haub, a demographer at the nonprofit Population Reference Bureau. He says in a recession, people who lose their jobs can't afford to have a kid, so they don't. And folks who do have a job worry they could lose it, so they delay having kids. History seems to bear out Haub's theory. During the Great Depression, births dropped a massive 14%.
To an average of 2.1 children per woman. In the 1970s, with a very rapid inflation, the birth rate fell to its lowest in our history, 1.7 children per woman.
Most experts don't imagine such a drastic drop this time around. The baby bust of the 1970s, remember, also coincided with the growing popularity of the pill. And it's not like hard economic times keep couples from baby-producing activities. In fact, quite the opposite, at least according to Katie Zavallarin. She's a spokesperson for Adam and Eve. They sell what we'll politely call marital aids, and their sales are up 6% over this time last year.
I think more people are probably staying home, trying not to spend a lot of money. Instead of going on little getaways, I think people are trying to have some romantic time and hopefully using some of our products.
So how much of a baby bust, if any, will we actually see? Demographers say they'll have a better idea in, about 9 months. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
We're always told to save for a rainy day. Well, I'd say it's coming down pretty hard right now, wouldn't you agree? And the problem is, of course, that most people did not save. In fact, the average household is more than $9,000 in debt, and that doesn't count mortgages. 20% of our incomes goes to paying that off every month instead of piling it up in a savings account. But Marketplace's Eve Tro tells us there is help out there should you want to resurrect the lost art of saving.
Okay, time to fess up. That hot pink dress you never wore, that treadmill that turned into a clothes rack, what did it cost? Come on, you can tell me. Or you can tell the whole world at spendster.org.
Coffee maker is spotless. As you can see, it has never been used. That's why. And we'll look over here. Golf clubs. Nice, right? Guess who doesn't play golf?
Spendster users upload video confessions about overbuying, like this one. A ticker adds up all the money wasted, more than $200,000 so far, and the site's only been up a couple weeks. The stories are all too relatable.
They make us squirm because we're all spendsters.
Ted Beck is CEO of the National Endowment for Financial Education. He started Spendster. The idea was born on a coffee break. Beck mentioned a drawer at home full of unused stuff, and he wondered how much it was all worth. Everyone chimed in with their own stories.
It went from a drawer to a closet to a garage, and we all were kind of laughing and outdoing each other. We were all learning from it. This wasn't a sort of a little secret that each of us had.
The site adds a moral to these tales of consumption. You enter what you spent on something you didn't need, and it tells you what you'd have now if you'd invested or saved that money. That $25 on coffee last week, it could have been $120 for retirement. Again, Ted Beck.
Our goal is to turn that into a teachable moment where we can bring back the idea of living within your income.
It's a show-don't-tell approach, and more people are adopting it. Sites like SmartyPig.com. It's an internet bank with a social networking twist. You start an online savings account with a goal in mind, a vacation, an iPod, textbooks. Friends and family can chart your progress or even help you out, but you only get the cash when you meet the goal. Musette Bracker is a vice president at Government Employees Credit Union in El Paso, Texas. She says turning a spender into a saver is a long process. She compares it to dieting.
We all try diets on our own. It's just too hard to do. But put it in a group setting, put it in a competitive type setting, and the results are amazing.
Bracker started a savings challenge program in El Paso last year. It's like the reality show The Biggest Loser, but with saving money instead of losing weight. 6 credit union customers get personal training for their pocketbooks and check in over a year to measure progress. The winner gets $10,000, and the stories are all documented on local TV, in English and in Spanish.
El ahorro GZU Saving Challenge 07.
No he tenido tentación de activar una tarjeta nueva.
Gloria Aguilar, a 53-year-old single mom, had about $30,000 in credit card debt when she started the savings challenge.
I was living paycheck to paycheck. As a matter of fact, at the beginning of the savings challenge, I think that I bounced like 3 checks. And at that point, I wanted to give up.
The contest made her take a hard look at her spending. $500 a month on fast food, impulse buys. She took a second job and chipped away at those bad habits. By the end of the year, Aguilar paid almost all the debt, and she won the challenge. Now she smiles at the tellers in the credit union.
And I feel pride when they look at my accounts. Before, it was embarrassing.
Creator Musette Bracker says the contest is more than a feel-good thing, though. It's a research tool. Contestants like Gloria Aguilar prove that it's not that people don't want to save. They never learned how.
Regardless of education, income, they don't know where to start. And it really told us that we needed to quit being a preacher, if you will, and show people actually how they could start making changes in their financial habits.
Bracker believes financial educators and institutions need a makeover of their own. If they relate to people's money problems instead of punishing them, more will come back into the savings fold. In Los Angeles, I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, Cuba is celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Communist Revolution there, if you can call it a celebration. Festivities have been drastically toned down because of the continued absence of President Fidel Castro, whose health is believed to be in jeopardy 2.5 years after major surgery. And the country is still reeling from a string of hurricanes that caused $10 billion in damages. Castro's brother Raul recently called for nationwide cost-cutting measures in the wake of slow economic growth. And that is your first Marketplace of 2009 from American Public Media. The markets were closed for the holiday today. Our editors include Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker. The managing editor is George Judson. Next time on the program, 2008 was filled with financial acronyms, but did they help us understand things any better?
CDO. I have no clue.
Collateralized debt obligation. And nobody quite knows what they are unless you work for an investment bank.
Not sure they did either. I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.